Hello, and welcome to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com, a show exploring the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. I'm Louis Moroni, and for this week's show, we will be listening to a talk from the Marxism 2013 conference, which was held at Ryerson University from May 31st to June 2nd. The conference was organized by the International Socialists, an organization of activists committed to helping in the construction of such a party through ongoing activity in the mass organizations of the working class and in the daily struggles of workers and the oppressed. My ATC partner Jim Vernon recorded the following talk by Pam Frake, called Why is Capitalism in Crisis? She talks about the sources of the current economic crisis in terms of long-term trends within financial capital. Pam is a leading member of the International Socialists. She is a former labor researcher and current graduate student at McMaster University. To find out more info about her and our show, please go to afterthecollapse.net. We hope you enjoy the recording and Pam's music selections included throughout.
Thank you very much. And thanks, everybody, for coming out to hear this talk. I think, obviously, it's a timely talk because the world economy is certainly precarious, I think it's fair to say. I was struck in the weeks leading up to doing this talk about all the rosy headlines that are coming through, like, you know, Europe breathes a sigh of relief, you know, as Cyprus and Greek bailout monies are resolved. Consumers are optimistic, you know, we're turning a corner. And I was kind of struck by all of that, you know, rosy, kind of a rosy analysis. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, fake it till you make it kind of thing. Because when you actually start digging in and looking a little bit at what the mainstream economists are saying, is the picture is not at all rosy. And certainly, you know, the best thing can be said about Greece is that they were able to get their, you know, their operating deficit more or less down to zero, but their, you know, but their long-term debt is at 175% of GDP. That unemployment is the highest in the Eurozone, with a 67% unemployment rate for young people, for young workers, which is just absolutely extraordinary, and so forth. So, you know, at best, I think that people can say it's certainly a precarious recovery. I'm not sure if folks in this room will remember, but when the economic crisis first hit in 2007, 2008, there was this notion that, you know, it's all going to be fine because the emerging economies are going to save us. So the BRIC companies, the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and what's the third? China, thank you. Hello, the big one. But it's interesting if you actually look at what the headlines are saying about those countries. I just printed off a few headlines from various Financial Times and Economist articles. So this article on Brazil from May 29th, headline is, Brazil, economic growth disappoints again. The next one on Russia's economic outlook worsens, rate cuts seen in third quarter. So rate cuts, the rate of growth. India, economic growth at slowest rate in a decade. And then, of course, China, the headline here, again, May 31st, China economy losing steam amid poor local and foreign demand. And I think that's important, and I'll come back to explain how those phenomena are related a little bit later. So I think, while, you know, some may not necessarily agree that we're in crisis, people believe that we're in a recovery, I think it's certainly fair to say that it's a precarious recovery, if it's a recovery at all. One of the reasons why we're seeing such a prolonged and steady state of crisis is the impact of austerity. So, you know, for 5 years now, the medicine on offer for the economic crisis has been austerity. And so, and what that essentially does, austerity means cutting back on public services, it means cutting back on wages, it means adding to unemployment and so forth. And of course, it makes perfect sense in that context that demand is going to be suppressed. So the demand that previously existed, like take Canada for instance, where consumer demand has been, you know, next to the oil sector, has been like a key pillar of the Canadian economy because people are continuing to buy stuff and keep, you know, local businesses operating. But then when you lay off 10,000 or 20,000 public servants, guess what happens? Those public sector workers don't have the disposable income anymore, and they stop buying. And so suddenly, the local flower shop can't sustain itself, and so forth. And so this problem of aggregate demand has really worsened And certainly at the state level, it becomes an issue because it's not absorbing the products, the supplies that companies produce and so forth. And actually, the reason why I wanted to talk about that is because I wanted to introduce some of the other explanations for the crisis, for why the economy is in crisis. And I would say that the dominant explanation has been from the Keynesian variety. And so the Keynesians believed that crisis occurred when there was a problem with aggregate demand. And so the role that the state should play should be to actually take measures to increase demand. And so there's sort of two policy areas, fiscal and monetary policy, the notion that you should increase state spending on infrastructure and services, while at the same time increasing the money supply. So the central bank would intervene to reduce interest rates, which makes it less attractive to keep your money in a bank and more attractive to invest it in a more profitable area of the economy. And it also makes it much less expensive for business to be able to borrow money and invest it and so forth. And so this was supposed to actually help mitigate the economic crisis. And so while Keynesians understood that there's a business cycle, the booms and the busts, what they sought to do, what this school thought seeks to do is to mitigate those boom-bust cycles so that instead of it being like this, that you kind of take the edge off the top and you take the edge off the bottom. And so you kind of stabilize the system and minimize the ups and downs that create such chaos and hardship for ordinary people. But of course, one of the challenges with this is that when the system really was in crisis after a period of kind of Keynesian hegemony, one might say, in the mid-1970s, what they found is when they actually introduced those policies, in fact, it didn't mitigate the crisis. It introduced a period of what they call stagflation. So the increase in the money supply contributed to inflation, which devalues wages and so forth. And at the same time, it made it an inhospitable climate for business investment. And so you had to that point, it had never been experienced before, a period of stagnation and inflation. So, and I think this is important because for most of us on the progressive end of the political spectrum, people talk about the rise of neoliberalism. And at some point in time, mysteriously, all the good guys got replaced with the Chicago School economists, and we don't ever really know why. It just kind of happened. It's like some people look to Polanyi, this notion that there's a double movement. So it's just sort of a pendulum. It just sort of happens. No one can really explain why, but it shifts to this direction and it shifts to that direction, and these things just happen. And just having had a chance to read a little bit of Gramsci last semester, I can say that this approach is what Gramsci would call speculative or metaphysical, because it doesn't actually root it in the material conditions of what's happening. And so what I wanted to try and argue with this talk is that my own view is that Marxism gives us much better tools to understand what's happening in the system, but also better tools to be able to shape our resistance to the system. It better informs us and better equips us to be able to anticipate outcomes and therefore to be able to intervene effectively on the interests of the majority of humanity. And so that's why it's not about tit for tat or anything like that, but to just look at Keynesianism and what the weaknesses are with that. And of course, one of the consequences of an economic strategy that can't actually deliver, that can't marshal capitalism, bring capitalism under control, is that when political parties, like social democratic parties, when they get into government office, and they attempt to influence the economy using Keynesian tools and find they're unable to do so, very often it means flip-flops. So the sort of whole history of social democracy has been about a radical program in the lead-up to elections, radical program in the lead-up to elections, and then suddenly, a more conservative, perhaps even neoliberal approach when in office. And that's not just because people are, intellectually weak or somehow not courageous or somehow not principled, but it's because their notion of managing the capitalist economy in order to make sure that it's healthy enough to deliver profits that can then be redistributed, what they find is that the very things to bring capitalism to health, to create the profit to redistribute, is actually turning on workers and helping to basically make workers pay for the capitalist crisis. you know, always hoping at some point in the future to be able to redistribute and reinvest and so forth. And that's the shortcoming. And so what happens in that period of time is a number of things. People who had huge expectations in these political parties are suddenly disappointed. And in that moment, it can lead to very reactionary conclusions. And I'll come back to that in the current context because I think it's important and it matters.
Caution, we're coming for your head. So call the feds and get files to shred. Every textbook read said bring you the bread. But guess what, we got you instead.
Welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. That was The Coup with the song The Guillotine, a selection by Pam Frake, who is our featured speaker today, recorded at Ryerson University as part of the Marxism 2013 conference. You can visit our website at afterthecollapse.net. Pam has been presenting her talk called Why is Capitalism in Crisis? It's on the sources of the current economic crisis in terms of long-term trends within financial capital.
And so that's, you know, the weakness of having that a kind of top-down notion that you can actually get the economy back under control really has, you know, it's difficult to execute, and it can lead to serious disillusionment and demoralization. And very often people can be open to more right-wing explanations for what's happening. Now, the flip side of the Keynesian approach is what, you know, you might call the neoclassical approach or the neoliberal approach. And what's interesting, in some ways, that is a much more class-conscious, ruling class-conscious approach. And there are actually elements of truth in their analysis, because they do argue that the reason that crises emerge is that investment begins to slow. They argue that it's because wages have become a break and a barrier to continued investment and economic prosperity. And so their solution is to actually take the boots to the working class, to do whatever they can to cut wages, but also to cut the social wage through cuts in social program spending and so on and so forth. And their rationale is that they want to re-incentivize investment and by doing so. And but the difficulty with this scenario is that while there is an element of truth, the reason capitalism goes into crisis is because the profitability is not what it used to be. And so there's a number of things that corporations need to do to restore profitability. One thing that they try to do is to reduce wage costs. And this is significant when we come to look at a Marxist perspective, because it's actually that very process that winds up contributing to the crisis, even though it is also what is required for the rate of profit to be returned to something that is going to create incentives for investments and so forth. So since the 1970s, we really have experienced a period of time when wages have been under assault more or less the world over, and rising inequality is a common phenomenon with, you know, even in the Scandinavian countries, for example, like Sweden and so forth, there's rising and record high levels of inequality, the gap between the people at the top and the gap between people at the bottom. So what is a Marxist explanation of the crisis? And I guess here I want to talk about sort of three aspects that I think are to frame how I explain the kind of Marxist contribution, and that is competition, the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, and crisis. And those three things are very important to the way capitalism actually works. So essentially, then with competition, companies are constantly in trying to outproduce their competitors. They want to capture a greater market share and so forth. And one of the ways that people make their goods and services more attractive than others is to try and figure out ways to reduce the price. And because the cost of materials and equipment that goes into producing a product, you know, basically it costs the same going in, it costs the same going out. It doesn't really add value. The only place where value is added is in terms of the labor that people add to it. And that's because living labor or labor power is it's not static. So it can be, it actually fluctuates. And in fact, you know, people kind of refer to labor power as effort. And the thing that makes labor power different than any other commodity that goes into production is that labor power has the ability to produce more than it actually absorbs in wages. And so because of that, it actually adds value to the products, and it's actually that surplus value that contributes to the rate of profit for corporations. And so, interestingly enough, when workers add to the fixed costs of capital and raw materials and so forth, they produce more value. They produce products that have more value than what went into them. That's the profit rate and so forth. But by the same token, there's an interest for corporations to try and cut back on labor power in order to minimize the cost. And there's a rationale for doing that in the short term, because if you can produce something twice as fast as your competitor, it's going to cost half the cost, more or less, once you take out the fixed cost that would go into both products. So there's a real interest in trying to figure out how to make the price cheaper, And when the price is cheaper in that short term, then you can capture a greater part of the market. So if you were selling chairs at $10 and suddenly you can sell them at $5, well, that's a fantastic thing. And if you monopolize the market for that period of time, you're going to reap big rewards and probably create some hardship for your competitors. But of course, that's only when you have the technology that allows you to do that. Once other companies start introducing either the same technology or the same techniques and so forth, and they too can reduce the prices of goods, then they enter the market and they do so. And so there's a pressure generally on the price of products to come down. And yet there's also simultaneous pressure to be reinvesting more and more in means of, what Marx called the means of production, or what we might call technology, or additional plant and so forth. And so that sort of dual pressure, greater investment in the means of production, combined with cheaper prices because you're trying to compete with your competitors, creates a dynamic where over time, the tendency is for the rate of profit to fall. And that, in so many ways, is the root of prices, and it's a product of competition. This competition is incredibly important because it drives the pace of production, and because so many people are competing all the time, the pressure is permanent. And I think for folks who were here at the opening session yesterday, we heard Ludwig talk about the dynamic of capitalism, which is to just intensify the pace at which we innovate, the pace at which we work, and so forth. And that's all pressure that is generated not by individuals with backward ideas in their head, but because this is a dynamic of capitalism, that if you don't compete on that basis, if you are not constantly trying to increase your rate of production, then you're going to fall by the wayside. And that's where the question of crisis comes in. Because essentially, when more and more and more competitors come into the market, even liberal economics would suggest this, there is an erosion of the profits. There's sort of more people in the market, more distribution, until finally reaches a tipping point where people can't manage to keep up and they start going out of business. And very often it creates a whole cyclical problem where a plant goes under in one portion of the economy, but then suddenly other businesses are affected because they can't purchase the goods and services and so forth. And so you kind of get this exacerbating kind of dynamic. And it's actually by driving competition out of the market, that destructive moment of capitalism is precisely what creates the condition for profitability in the future. Because when you drive people out of the market, when you got wages and so forth, then all of a sudden you have a lot more profit to go around, there's less competition and so on and so forth. And that's why when we look back historically, even though people claim that it was Keynesian economics in the form of the New Deal in the 1930s that helped lead the way out of the recession, a lot of economists will acknowledge that, in fact, it was the war, that, in fact, even after the New Deal, the economy was tipping back into recession, but it was the impact of World War II that combined both a massive amount of state spending in the form of weapons and military competition, but also massive destruction of capital and of jobs and so forth. And the consequences of that, of course, we know.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The spikes of the bosses we must fight for. The trenches full of mud. War's always been the boss's wiser. The union forever defending our rights. Now with the black leg, the workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters in many far off lands. There is power in a union. Now I long for the morning. And unjust laws cannot defeat us. But who'll defend the workers who cannot organize? When the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us. Money speaks for money, the devil for his own. Who comes to speak for the sky?
skin and the bone. What a comfort to the widow, a light to the child. There is power in our union.
Welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. That was Billy Bragg with the song There's Power in a Union, a selection by Pam Frake, who is our featured speaker today, recorded at Ryerson University as part of the Marxism 2013 conference. You can visit our website at afterthecollapse.net. Pam has been presenting her talk called Why is Capitalism in Crisis? It's on the sources of the current economic crisis in terms of long-term trends within financial capital.
So in that sense, those are the dynamics that I think really define the system. And although a lot of people will argue that the whole question of labor theory of value and the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, Marx argued that there were countervailing trends. There are things that happen that push back against those tendencies. But in the long run, there is that kind of general downward pressure. So a lot of people have now claimed that those concepts are out of date, but there's actually a whole new school that are beginning to relook at Marxist analysis of the economy. And in fact, I'll just draw attention to people who are economists in the room. There's a fantastic contribution by an academic named Andrew Kleiman from the U.S. who actually uses current data to make a very strong case for the tendency of the rate of profit to fall and locating the source of crisis in that crisis of profitability that emerged in the mid-1970s. So it's on the book table if people want to go check it out. But it's excellent new material. Thank you. The other thing I wish I had a PowerPoint to display, but I also wanted to just give you some charts and diagrams that various economists have put forward. So this chart is done by a financial company that is trying to give advice to people about how to invest their stocks and so forth. And it shows, and no one will be able to see this, but I'll just describe it and then pass it around. It shows how the rate of investment has basically been going up over time. And how the number of people employed have been going down over time. And when you see that, it really speaks to what Marx called the organic composition of labor, where the constant capital in relation to the variable capital, which is the labor power part, gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's actually that leads to crisis. And I just thought this graph is just completely crystal clear if people want to take a look at it. And of course, the whole question of wages that I mentioned, this is a graph that just shows disposable income in the United States, the difference between 1962 to 1979, and then from 1980 to 2011. And it's very clear that they're two different periods. So I'll just flag it at that. And even just this past week, I was at a Canadian Industrial Relations Association conference where there were speakers from Ford Motor Company addressing the audience, and they basically acknowledged that in the early 2000s they had 70% of the market, but by the mid 2000s it had fallen to about 55%. And then fell even further in the years after the economic crisis. And they basically said, we had to do massive restructuring and we mortgaged everything we could get our hands on with this huge gamble that we're going to be able to restore our profitability. And in doing so, they put a massive investment in the state-of-the-art technology. Like, it is astonishing how much stuff is now produced robotically and so forth, displacing all kinds of semi-skilled labor that used to be required for this kind of production. And in the process, they reduced their wage costs by 50%. It's absolutely mind-boggling. And that's through a series of layoffs, and that's through forced concessions from the workers there. So they're able to say that although they last year they produced a record number of vehicles, the number of people are employed in the sector has now fallen to a rate that was prevalent in the mid-1980s. So I think, again, that speaks to this dynamic of capital where more and more and more goes into plant and equipment, less and less into workers themselves. And because workers are, in fact, the source of all new value, the smaller proportion that contributes to production, the less new value is actually created. And that's part of what winds up contributing to the crisis. So now if we understand that crisis is really important to the system, I want to flag a couple of other dynamics, especially, I think we've certainly been feeling this, we can see it much more clearly after the financial crisis in 2007-2008, but it is a factor that's been prevalent probably, you know, for decades, and that is the notion that as capitalism grows and globalizes, there is a tendency toward the concentration and centralization of capital. So in other words, there's corporations that get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so technically what should be happening during a capitalist crisis is that those competitors should be driven out of the market. But some of these corporations are now so big that their value, their productivity is greater than the GDP of some developed nations. And so they can't let those companies go to the wall, because if they were to do so, it would have such a terrible cascading effect on other sectors of the economy, never mind the destabilization aspect of, in terms of the social upheaval and so forth that it would create, is that there's much more of a propensity for the ruling classes to intervene to spare those companies from going under. And I think the best example that we all know of now is the Lehman Brothers situation. When Lehman went under in the immediate aftermath of the financial crisis, that's when Armageddon, you know, the U.S. that had been, you know, not sure if they were going to bail out and so on and so forth, turned around and was able to make literally trillions of dollars available to the banks to make sure that no other bank goes under. And I was trying to look up current estimates of what the banking crisis has represented, but it's something like over $76 trillion have been sunk into banks around the world to keep them afloat. And so forth. And of course, where does money come from when states intervenes? Well, money more or less these days comes primarily from working people. So working people get it twice. They get ripped off at the point of production wherever they're working, and then they get ripped off in terms of the taxes they pay that are supposed to go to providing the social wage and so forth. But instead, that too now gets redirected into the economy. And this is because the people, you know, the ruling class is trying very hard to prop up the rate of profit. And you can see this everywhere. You know, most business and analysts will now say that, you know, it's common knowledge that profit margins are, quote, razor thin. And in fact, I was at a meeting last year with a bunch of employers. It was for work to discuss EI premiums. And of course, all the employers were saying we need to reduce the employer contributions to EI premiums and so on and so forth. It's dampening our ability to generate jobs and so forth. And they basically said our profit, the rate of profit in the communication sector, is directly related to the corporate tax cuts that had been implemented in the years previous. And without those corporate tax cuts, their sector would not be profitable. So you can see how corporate tax cuts are, you know, again, it's a direct intervention to deflect and rechannel resources from working people into the corporations. And that's really how fragile, the system actually is. So where does this leave us? That's the whole kind of too big to fail kind of dynamic. But the other thing about globalization now, how it is unfolded, is that there are actually generally way fewer and way more limited policy options for governments, because as the rhythm of capitalism has become much more globalized and much more integrated, in fact, the policy options that states have to be able to bring the economy back to health is far more diluted than they used to be. So, for example, the notions in the 1930s where investment could go into infrastructure and stimulate production and so forth, when you have a situation where most of the production is now offshored from low-wage economies, injecting capital into a domestic market doesn't necessarily create the spin-off effects at home. It can often have the effect of creating spin-off effects in other economies. And so it means that there's a diluted impact of these policy measures that might have been more effective in previous times. The other thing is that if you take a look at interest rates right now, it's like, goodness, you know, we're supposedly in an economy, interest rates are, 1% in Canada, the lowest rates of, or interest rates are at the lowest levels in decades and decades. And there's no way that they can actually reduce interest rates any further. So in terms of policy options, like, we're basically maintaining our recovery. But the notion of, let's try reducing interest rates. It's like, oh, wait a minute, they're already at zero. It's like, oh, okay, guess we can't do that. So there's sort of an exhaustion of the policy options that are available to governments as well. And again, that undermines the progressive notions that you can, seize the reins of the state and channel the state in a direction that will benefit working people. And that also contributes to the weakness of social democracy, because their old strategies are not working. There is genuine fear in the, business sector and so forth.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about the revolution. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no.
Welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. That was Tracy Chapman with the song Talking About a Revolution, a selection by Pam Frake, who is our featured speaker today, recorded at Ryerson University as part of the Marxism 2013 conference. You can visit our website at afterthecollapse.net. Pam has been presenting her talk called Why is Capitalism in Crisis? It's on the sources of the current economic crisis in terms of long-term trends within financial capital.
Even though the absolute level of profits, like the numbers, are often bigger than we've ever seen before, the rate of profit is what matters, and it's whether you get a 10% return on your investment or a 1% return on your investment or a 0.5% return on investment. And in a period where the return on investment is not lucrative, then when there is capital that's available, it looks for more lucrative options. So that helps to explain investment in the financial sectors. So if the profitability in the quote real economy, where you actually produce things, is 0.5%, 1% or whatever, people are not going to want to put their money there. They're going to want to invest it in something that can maybe try 5%, 7%, 10%, and so forth. And actually, that's the history of the banking sector for the last few decades, of these incredibly, you know, revolting returns to investment, which helps to explain the avalanche of resources of capital that went into the financial sector, and this huge amount of, you know, disgusting levels of profit. But it also came tumbling down and created a giant global crisis. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because even the financial sector is still subject to the same laws of competition as other sectors of the economy. And in May, the Economist magazine put out a special issue about the crisis in the banking sector. In addition to the debt that everybody is trying to address and so forth, in addition to the debt, the return on investments now has been halved at the present time when compared with just 12 years ago, where it was double-digit returns and so forth. It's been halved. And they're predicting that rate of return is going to start is very likely going to contract even further. And again, what will be required is to drive competitors out of business and so forth, more concentration and centralization of the banks, which means, you know, I don't want to, you know, paint a picture of catastrophism, but I wanted to paint a picture of incredible instability. And it actually matters in terms of the strategy that are on offer. And I guess I want to talk a little bit about the situation in Europe, because where you look at the countries where the crisis is most prevalent, to take Greece or Cyprus and so forth, and it is true they've just got through the next bailout agreement, and so they'll have some cash to tide them over for the next little while. But that debt never goes away. And even though there's some progressives that suggest that what should happen in the European Union is a much more integration of the economy, so that instead of just sharing a currency and, you know, a modicum of political input, that people should also share the debt. So all the debt that Greece has would be shared with countries like Germany and France and so forth, and so it wouldn't just be concentrated in one country. But nevertheless, increasing the debt and sharing the debt simply creates more hardship for workers in those countries, because it will mean more money going from workers through the state into corporations to pay back the deficits and so forth. And it goes without saying that when people say Greece is getting bailed out, it's not Greece that's getting bailed out. It's all of the banks in France and Germany that are getting bailed out, because that's who Greece owes the money to. So this bailout of Greece is not a bailout of Greece at all. It's a bailout of Germany and France and the supposedly strong economies. And the irony is that after all of these years of austerity, you have a situation where those countries that used to buy the goods that were produced by the roaring economy, the roaring export economy of Germany, they suddenly can't buy Germany's stuff anymore. So guess what? Germany's growth is now slowing. France is now officially in a recession and so forth. So you can see how all of these things are completely integrated. Same thing goes for China. The reason why China's economy is slowing is because all those countries like Canada and the US that used to buy all of the stuff it produced are not able to buy the stuff it produces anymore, thanks to austerity. And so China's economy is slowing and so forth. And one last thing I'll just say about monetary interventions. The thing that many economists have been talking about is this propensity toward asset bubbles and stock market bubbles and property price bubbles. The reason why there's such a propensity for that is related to the dynamics of the economy. So let's say, take China, where there's a massive stimulus spending was put into play. Well, it's the same dynamics. Like, where are we going to invest that money? Are we going to invest that money in production where it's maybe negligible returns? Or maybe we'll buy some property, and maybe we'll guess that with the state going along and investing in all sorts of infrastructure, that the property prices will go up. And before you know it, you have a property price bubble occurring and so forth. And it's because capital doesn't want to invest where the rate of return is low. They want to invest where the rate of return is high. So that means that into the property markets, but then maybe out of the property markets, into the stock markets, out of the stock markets, and this volatility that's now facilitated by technology and computer programs and so forth, there can be massive amounts of financial swings in literally seconds. And so what I think, you know, I don't want to paint a picture of catastrophism, but I do want to paint a picture of incredible volatility, where I think what we can look forward to is not a return to growth and not a scenario where everything's rosy and wages are rising and so forth. I think that we can look forward to, you know, more and more recoveries that are almost indistinguishable from recessions, that we can look forward to more volatility in the stock markets, more potential threats of asset bubble bursting and so forth, and an ongoing and persistent drive on the part of corporations to drive down wages, to throw people out of work, and so on and so forth. In short, it is class war over who is going to pay for the economic crisis. And it's not a war that's going to be over overnight, I can assure you that much. When I talk about Greece, it does actually matter, because out of this this crisis, there has been phenomenal resistance among ordinary people who are questioning the dynamics of the system, and a new political party has emerged called Syriza, which is, you know, it's I would say a radical alternative to social democracy, which has been just terrible in Greece and has helped to usher in austerity and so forth. So this incredible explosion of support for this alternative party. But they don't have an anti-capitalist analysis. And so they really believe that if they can just get the Eurozone to the bargaining table and they can just renegotiate the debt and the and the payments, thank you. If they can just, you know, fiddle around the edges, they can strengthen the euro, they can keep Greece and the Eurozone, and that all things will be fine. If they can just share the debt, it'll all be fine. And people have great expectations because, of course, they just want things to return to normal. And so there's going to be huge expectations. But it really matters that there's an organization also putting forward an anti-capitalist perspective, because the Eurozone is primarily a boss's trade zone that is interested in maintaining the value of the euro, to be a competitor to the North American economy and so forth, to be an alternative pole of financial attraction to the United States and Asian countries and so forth. In that context, the movements have to start seriously thinking about not only exiting from the Eurozone, but actually exiting altogether from capitalism, because clearly capitalism needs crisis and misery and hardship for working people to sustain itself. It is the, you know, people describe capitalism booms and crisis as the inhale and exhale of the system. There's no way to take out crisis from capitalism, because that's required to make it function smoothly in the future. And that's why for many of us who are here this weekend, we believe that as Marx said, it shouldn't be about just interpreting the world and understanding the world, it needs to also be about changing it. And to that extent, I think a Marxist analysis gives us much better tools to understand both what is happening, but also what we need to do to change it. And that means not relying on governments, not relying on corporations, but actually relying on the millions and millions of people around the world who produce everything and who have the ability to actually create a better world. And I'll just leave it at that.
Thanks for listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. You've been listening to Pam Frake's talk, Why is Capitalism in Crisis?, presented at the Marxism 2013 conference at Ryerson University, which ran from May 31st to June 2nd. She talked about the sources of the current economic crisis in terms of long-term trends within financial capital. You can find out more about the conference and the other speakers that were presented there at Marxism2013.com. Pam also writes for socialist.ca. You can learn more about this episode and listen to past episodes of After the Collapse at afterthecollapse.net. I am Lewis Maroney, and the talk was recorded by my co-host, Jim Vernon. Thanks again.